Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 50. Divine dissatisfaction. What to do, who to be. Show features a book by Paul Hawken called Blessed Unrest: How the Largest Social Movement in History is Restoring Grace, Justice, and Beauty to the World. Paul Hawken is also the author of The Ecology of Commerce, and perhaps one of his first books was The Magic of Findhorn. Show continues with the topic from last week's conversation about meditation and activism. The book is chock full of references, names, people, places. Explore some of that, plus the interesting viewpoints it presents. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Findhorn's an amazing community in Scotland. It's a spiritual community, Echo Village. It has worldwide renown. It started off maybe the 60s or 70s with Dorothy MacLean and Elaine and Peter Caddy. They were friends. They meditated together or individually, and Dorothy MacLean started having communications with the spirits of the plants and the vegetables, the devas, and they received guidance and started growing vegetables in a virtually parking lot kind of conditions. And anyway, that was a book that, one of the books Paul Hawken wrote about them. And that's a wonderful book, amazing community to learn about the the spirit guidance that goes along with what we typically consider to be very earthy and perhaps mundane, important in today's world with all the agribusiness, kind of an agrarian mysticism, a phrase that has stuck with me from the show about the phallus. And so Paul Hawkins' book here, Blessed Unrest, touches in on similar topics of connecting with Earth and how do we deal with things that are going on in the world. It's a book that I would like to get into more. It came out in 2007, meaning that it is so chock full with references and an appendix that is about 80, 90 pages, book notes, people, topics, organizations. It's perhaps the best list of sort of under the radar NGO type organizations that are doing positive things in the world. And that's why this book is quite refreshing, because you know, read a lot of news and tend to get see what's not going right, but this book really highlights what is going right and tons of people that are actually working towards that, for that. So it kind of restores one's faith. Opening section has a quote from Martha Graham, famous dancer, Martha Graham to Agnes DeMille, dance to the piper. There is vitality, a life force and energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action, and because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. You have to keep open and aware directly to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer, divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others. So that's where the book title comes from and the title of this show. Now, it's kind of it's an interesting comment on this, because from the Taoist perspective and Buddhist in a way, the you know, sense of contentment and rest and being satisfied is an essential part of the philosophy and way of living. But also, the book, you know, I understand the phrase that there's a certain way to be, to hold both. I think that the Tao also allows for that, with the holding of opposites into a unified duality. So I know personally my life, there's, as much as there's a satisfaction, there's an ongoing dissatisfaction in a way that is how to improve things and how to, you know, fine tune and refine. So that's the context that my understanding of this, of the title of the show, Divine Dissatisfaction, and where the book is coming from. Now, the chapter titles are interesting. The Beginning, Blessed Unrest, The Long Green, The Rights of Business, Emerson's Savants, Indigene, We Interrupt This Empire, Immunity, and Restoration. So it's nice that the whole chapter and much of the consciousness of the book connecting with the indigenous peoples. The book is about 200 pages written, and then the appendix is about another 100 pages. It starts off with agriculture and farming, with subcategories agricultural policy, agricultural water conservation and management, agroecology, farm ecosystem management, composting, biological control, livestock in developing nations. And within each of these sections, there's information. Livestock raising in Africa and similar ecoregions cannot be compared with the beef industry in more developed nations. And then it has, after each of those explanatory paragraphs, there are sort of words or catchphrases: pastoralism, transhumance, livestock investment, agro-silvo-pastoralism. So this book is just a plethora and a treasure trove of phrases, ideas, categories, connecting with organizations and people. One could spend a lot of time with this book and really sort of be up on seemingly pretty much everything that's going on. Another section, Animalia, has something to do with bats, insects, mollusks, crustaceans, wildlife. And the other sections, biodiversity, arts, business, and economics, coastal and marine ecosystems, governance, population, water, work. So it goes on and on. And the book even begins with an indigenous perspective. Clayton Thomas Mueller speaks to a community gathering of the Cree Nation about waste sites on their native land in northern Alberta. Toxic lakes so big you can see them from outer space. Shi Li Hong, founder of Wild China, films documentaries with her husband on migrants displaced by construction of large dams. Rosalina Tuyek Velasquez, a member of the Maya Kakuko people, fights for full accountability for tens of thousands of victims of death squads in Guatemala. Rodrigo Baggio retrieves discarded computers from New York, London, and Toronto and installs them in the favelas, that's the sort of like the barrios, the favelas of Brazil, where he and his staff teach computer skills to poor children. Biologist Janine Benya speaks to 1,200 executives at a business forum in Queensland about biologically inspired industrial development. Paul Sykes, a volunteer for the National Audubon Society, completes his 52nd Christmas bird count in Little Creek, Virginia, joining 50,000 others who tally 70 million birds on one day. Sumita Dasgupta leads students, engineers, journalists, farmers, and Adivasis, tribal people, on a 10-day trek through Gujarat, exploring the rebirth of ancient rainwater harvesting and catchment systems that bring life back to drought-prone areas of India. Silas Kapanan Ayung Siakur exposes links between the genocidal policies of President Charles Taylor and illegal logging in Liberia, resulting in international sanctions and the introduction of certified sustainable timber policies. These eight individuals who may never meet and come to know one another are part of a coalescence comprising hundreds of thousands of organizations. It claims no special powers and arises in small, discrete ways like blades of grass after a rain. The movement grows and spreads in every city and country and involves virtually every tribe, culture, language, and religion from Mongolians to Uzbeks to Tamils. It is composed of families in India, students in Australia, farmers in France, the landless in Brazil, the bananeras of Honduras, the poors of Durban, villagers in Irianjaya, indigenous tribes of Bolivia, and housewives in Japan. Its leaders are farmers, zoologists, shoemakers, and poets. It provides support and meaning to billions of people in the world. The movement cannot be divided because it is so atomized, a collection of small pieces loosely joined. It forms, dissipates, and then regathers quickly without central leadership, command, or control. Rather than seeking dominance, this unnamed movement strives to disperse concentrations of power. It has been capable of bringing down governments, companies, and leaders through witnessing, informing, and massing. The quickening of the movement in recent years has come about through information technologies becoming increasingly accessible and affordable to people everywhere. Its clout resides in its ideas, not in force. Picture the collective presence of all human beings as an organism. Pervading that organism are intelligent activities, humanity's immune response to resist and heal the effects of political corruption, economic disease, and ecological degradation. Whether they are the result of free market, religious, or political ideologies. In a world grown too complex for constrictive ideologies, even the word movement to describe such a process may be limiting. Writer and activist Naomi Klein calls it the movement of movements. But for lack of a better term, I will stick with movement here because I believe all its components are beginning to converge. The movement has three basic roots: environmental activism, social justice initiatives, and indigenous cultures' resistance to globalization, all of which have become intertwined. Collectively, it expresses the needs of the majority of people on Earth to sustain the environment, wage peace, democratize decision-making and policy, reinvent public governance piece by piece from the bottom up, and improve their lives, women, children, and the poor. Throughout history, armies, corporations, religious rulers, and political zealots have overpowered the majority world, which in our upside-down world we consider to be minorities. It goes on to explain what each of the social justice means, and on, you can really get a sense of how inspiring the book is. Individual stories and the topics, the first few pages alone could keep one busy for a while. And as much as I like to go on and read other books, this book reminds me you can almost, you know, you find a book you could stick with, and in a way you cover a lot of territory that other books cover. And a little note about the chapters, Indigene and We Interrupt This Empire, concern globalization. Indigene is concerned with indigenous cultures. Their traditional lands represent the greatest remaining sanctuaries of life on Earth, and resource-hungry corporations are commercializing and destroying these biological arcs. That's what much of the protests and activity to stop that is about. Cultures that have co-evolved with these environments are resisting the encroachment, uniting with alliances of non-profits to bring accountability and limits to unchecked development. We Interrupt This Empire focuses on organizations that are engaged in protecting citizens, workers, and environments from the juggernaut of free market fundamentalism. Quote, ecologists and biologists know that systems achieve stability and health through diversity, not uniformity. Ideologues take the opposite view. So there's this, you know, awareness of even your lawn area where there's moss and grass and bugs, and, you know, there's an interaction that helps helps keep things functioning smoothly. And just wrote about this in an essay called The Cult of Monoculture, basically showing the detriments of the monoculture and the positives of the multiculture, or the blending, the holistic, multi-traditional way. So that's this book really provides a lot of answers, and it's a good reading too. Goes into a lot of you know, references and history in the chapter The Long Green. You know, it talks about philosophers, Voltaire and Jefferson and Locke, and post-Columbian era, mentioning DDT, and so it's quite a mix of, again, people, information, organizations, facts, and written in very, very wonderful style. Here's, with all the surveillance stuff, this is an interesting little section. As we understand more about species, we understand more about habitats. As we become more informed about biophysical changes to the planet, we better understand how industrial processes influence the metabolism of the planet. Perhaps the most difficult concept to grasp about climate change is how even minute changes in CO2 levels can magnify to have such potent effects. But it is not just carbon dioxide that does damage. The large influence of small changes to our environment appears repeatedly. When tadpoles are exposed to the pesticide atrazine at 1/30,000th of, quote, safe levels, 20% of them become hermaphroditic and sterile adults. Infinitesimal chemical exposure during development can have a drastically different effect from that at maturity. If natural El Niño cycles of rain and drought influence annual changes in speciation in Galapagos finches, consider the myriad long-term impacts of combusting 10 trillion pounds of mercury-bearing coal every year, or overspraying farms and suburbs of California with malathion to eliminate the Mediterranean fruit fly. The magnitude of such macro-activity creates countless micro-interactions that can't be tracked or monitored. So this stirs the emotions, because, you know, think of all the money and attention being spent on the surveillance and cameras, and really the real issue is all the relations, all our relations, and taking care of the earth. And some of that stuff can't be tracked because it's the natural process of it, but to track these these crimes against nature, that is where a good place for a lot of the high tech could be used in a more positive sense. References Thoreau in the book, and many native references. Will get into some of those quotes a little later on. And it's also, you know, very topical, political. If I'm going from Emerson and Thoreau, at this point, I think this is around maybe Civil War time. The country was convulsed by a civil war. Capitalism was thriving on the upheaval, with industry hastening to appropriate and exploit a divided nation's resources. General Sherman's march to the sea left a 60 by 300 mile swath of bridges, factories, railroads, and government buildings in ruin. Corruption was rife as the U.S. Treasury was emptied into the private sector to sustain the war, with the wartime levy on lamp fuel creating a surge in demand for recently discovered petroleum. John D. Rockefeller built his first refinery in Ohio and began his quest to monopolize petroleum using merciless tactics to drive competitors out of business. One of those competitors was renewable energy, which he battled just as ruthlessly as he did rival companies. The historian Lewis Mumford writes that in the war years, quote, the colors of American civilization abruptly changed. By the time the war was over, browns had spread everywhere, mediocre drabs, dingy chocolate browns, sooty browns that merged into black. In such grim conditions, the meaning of life became less important than the means of life. There was a necessity for inventive adaptation which turned men from the inner life to the outer one. For lack of an harmonious system of concepts and feelings, this necessary change did not lead to an intelligent adaptation of the environment. In the planning of cities and the layout of railroads, high roads, farms, in the exploitation of mineral resources and the utilization of the land, a good part of our soils and cities were ruined. Indeed, the new industrial towns were ruins from the beginning. So, getting into some of the origins of the problems today and where we went off track, perhaps helpful in learning to remedy the problems. And here's Emerson's Savants. Satyagraha is a three-step instrument of change, not a mere act of protest. The first step is to object to an unjust law or policy and petition for its removal. Absent an acceptable response, the second step is to break the law. The third step is to undergo the consequences, be they arrest, violence, abuse, or privation. Satyagraha means holding firmly to the truth in Hindi, and by following the process, remaining focused and calm within one's belief. The seeds of Satyagraha were sown in Gandhi long before he came to South Africa. Scholars argue whether Gandhi first read Civil Disobedience in 1906 or 1907, but whatever the case, it strengthened his resolve and influenced a fledgling movement. Throughout his life, Gandhi quoted the piece in letters, interviews, and articles as a buttress for the philosophy of Satyagraha. While both men made arrest a badge of honor in their struggle against injustice, Gandhi introduced it as an instrument of a mass movement rather than as a matter of individual conscience. Thoreau's principled dismissal of the ignominy and confinements of jail was also echoed faithfully by Gandhi from that point on. Final arrest and jailing occurred in January 1908, when apprehended a second time 9 months later for instigating a mass burning of registration certificates. He took Ruskin and Thoreau to jail with him so that he could find arguments in favor of our fight. Let's quote there. It could be said that in his influence on Gandhi, Thoreau was returning a favor, for the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads had demonstrably influenced his own thinking. Although Gandhi cited other influences on his thought, Tolstoy, the Sermon on the Mount, Socrates, and Ruskin, Thoreau was for him the one teacher besides Jesus who was both pragmatist and activist, a doer and not just a thinker. Thoreau was the philosopher who, in Gandhi's words, taught nothing he was not prepared to practice in himself. So there we have perhaps the just essential summing up of the convergence of activism and meditation. And I love how the way Hawking explains the full circleness of Thoreau being influenced by ancient Indian wisdom, and then Gandhi being influenced by Thoreau. So there's quite the wonderful cycles there. Also, on a verbal note, there's a ton of words in this book that are, I don't even know that I looked them all up, but a list of words to look up and learn from. So some examples: pejoratives, plebiscites, permaculture, heuristic, fungible, pinniped, mulligatawny. So it's a very, very erudite, but very accessible book. And again, the book hammers home that thing about, you know, small. We hear it over and over again. It's almost cliche, but necessary, that small, how much small actions make a difference. Maybe the best way to understand the future implications of the movement's daily actions is to remember Emerson's moral botany. Corn seeds produce corn. Justice creates justice, and kindness fosters generosity. How do we sow our seeds when large, well-intentioned institutions and intolerant ideologies that purport to be our salvation cause so much damage? One sure way is through smallness, grace, and locality. Individuals start where they stand, and, in Antonio Machado's poetic dictum, make the road by walking. Thoreau insisted in Civil Disobedience that if only one man withdrew his support from an unjust government, it would begin a cycle that would reverberate and grow. For him, there were no inconsequential acts, only consequential inaction. For it matters not how small the beginning may seem to be. What is once well done is done forever. The last part is a quote, presumably from Thoreau. I'll read that again. Thoreau insisted in Civil Disobedience that if only one man withdrew his support from an unjust government, it would begin a cycle that would reverberate and grow. For him, there were no inconsequential acts, only consequential inaction. For it matters not how small the beginning may seem to be, what is once well done is done forever. And the section on indigene, which is nice to see. I mean, it's good to read indigenous people's works directly, but also in the context of this book, to see a whole chapter and quotes and references is very, very nice. One of the introductory section quotes is by Wade Davis, The Ethnosphere and the Academy. We have this extraordinary conceit in the West that while we've been hard at work in the creation of technological wizardry and innovation, somehow the other cultures of the world have been intellectually idle. Nothing could be farther from the truth, nor is this difference due to some sort of inherent Western superiority. We now know to be true biologically what we've always dreamed to be true philosophically, and that is that we are all brothers and sisters. We are all, by definition, cut from the same genetic cloth. That means every single human society and culture, by definition, shares the same raw mental acuity, the same intellectual capacity. And whether that raw genius is placed in the service of technological wizardry or unraveling the complex threads of memory inherent in a myth is simply a matter of choice and cultural orientation. In 1492, the Inca Empire extended 2,200 miles down the coast of South America and was the largest on earth, greater than any country in Europe, greater than the Ottoman Empire, the Ming Dynasty, or the lands of Ivan the Great in Russia. The capital of the Mexica Aztec Empire, Tenochtitlan, was larger than the biggest city in Europe. Its markets, causeways, broad avenues, botanical gardens, temples, and immaculate sanitation system astounded the Spaniards. In North America, the Haudenosaunee, comprising today six nations, the Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Oneida, Mohawk, and Tuscarora, had a representative parliament complete with citizen referendums that dated back to 1142. This governing structure continues to this day, internally administered by female clan heads. Before these came Mayan, Hopewell, and Olmec cultures. Mesoamericans created 5,000 varieties of corn beginning 7,500 to 12,000 years ago. There are several theories as to the origin of corn, but scientists remain unsure how the wild cultivar was domesticated to become a staple. The Incas had developed 3,000 different types of potatoes suitable for every conceivable environment by the time of the Spanish invasion, which represented a model of agricultural sustainability as the staple crop could defend itself against any number of blights and variations in soil and weather. Today, corn is the largest grain crop by weight in the world, and three root vegetables developed in the Americas, potatoes, sweet potatoes, and cassava, are collectively the largest source of global calories. When you take into account in agriculture that also included coffee, cacao, tomatoes, avocado, peppers, cayenne, chilies, peanuts, cashews, tobacco, sunflower, safflower, vanilla, pineapple, papaya, blueberries, strawberries, passion fruit, pecans, butternut squash, pumpkin, zucchini, maple syrup, cranberry, tapioca from cassava, and a whole assortment of beans, It is not difficult to concede that American farmers were the leading plant breeders in history. Europeans who had gone chronically hungry for centuries came to an edible landscape farmed by people who, by and large, were well fed. Agriculture is culture, and the Americans have been cultured, one might say, gardened for a long time. But the list got me hungry, almost short of breath. Technologically, Western culture dances to preeminence with an iPod plugged into both ears. When it comes to innovation, literature, and creativity, it is dazzling. The ability to go deep into the ocean or as far as the moon is spectacular, but as Robert Oppenheimer reminded us, being blessed with technological insight does not confer self-insight. An important list here, he gives a list of companies and agencies that legally or illegally impose their will on indigenous cultures. And this is, sadly, 6 pages. Oil and gas, Chevron, Total S.A., ExxonMobil, Petronas, Talisman Energy, PetroChina, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, actually, and on and on and on, BP, Halliburton. We'll get into timber, a section on timber, section on mining, gold, dams and waterways, which includes World Bank, IFC, Belize Electric, Alcoa, Cargill, Midland, paper, coca, eradication. Oh, my mistake there. There was actually 6 pages. Actually, half of this list is the positives. Contrast this list of corporations and agencies to the network of organizations promoting environmental and social justice for indigenous people in just one region, the Amazon. So it's still a bit sad how many are in the abusive column, but this is an interesting list. Again, it gives you tons of references. Acción Ecología, Acción por la Vida, Bank Information Center, Bolivian Forum on Environment and Development, Pachamama Alliance, Pastoral Land Commission, Rainforest Action Network, Rainforest Information Center, Forest Peoples Program, Independent Federation of Shuar, People of Ecuador, Oil Watch, on and on. All of the NGOs listed above are assisted by a network with San Francisco-based Amazon Watch. As noted in the next chapter, Amazon Watch is a type of organization that exists around the world, a watch group which monitors, communicates, litigates, challenges, and publicizes a specific place, species, company, or issue. And one of the things this book taught me was if you ever want to start an organization or something local going on, you just find a good phrase for it. You know, people who live by the whatever and want to protect it or something, and you can start your own organization and start improving things. The juggernaut of growing corporate power cannot last forever. In Bolivia, an Aymara Indian, President Juan Evo Morales Ayma, a coca leaf farmer without a high school diploma, made good on his campaign promises and took charge of all gas fields in May 2006, declaring that any country had the sovereign right to control its own natural resources. The oil and gas companies had 6 months either to leave the country or to sign new contracts more favorable to the Bolivian people. The proposed renegotiation with foreign oil companies comes 25 years after the World Bank and IMF forced Bolivia to privatize its gas fields. Next section, we interrupt this empire. Of course, globalization does have potentially positive effects. They include dissolution of exclusionary political borders, increased transparency of political actors, connectivity among people around the world, and in general, a wealth of new opportunities in employment, education, and income. But these benefits obscure the liabilities, resource and worker exploitation, climate change, pollution, destruction of communities, and diminished biological diversity. What is lost in the concept of a globalized market is economic resiliency, the ability of regional economies to withstand bust and boom cycles. Also forsaken is economy security. When communities depend almost entirely on sources of production thousands of miles, if not continents away, they become spectral towns lined with fast food outlets and big box retailers. And another list of people. Again, you could, there's so many directions to go from this book. Talking about protests against the WTO, and who were the leaders? I said there are no leaders in the traditional sense, as there were in the civil rights, women's, or anti-war movements, but there are thought leaders. Who are they? She asked. Martin Kaur and Vandana Shiva of the Third World Network in Asia, Maud Barlow of the Council of Canadians, Tony Clark of Polaris Institute, Jerry Mander of the International Forum on Globalization, Susan George of the Transnational Institute, John Kavanaugh of the Institute for Policy Studies, Lori Wallach of Public Citizens, Anuradha Mittal, Owens Wiwa of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, and on and on. And there's a chapter called Immunity, touching on the web of life, and sections called Keeper Groups, Watch Organizations, Street Theater Groups, Social Entrepreneurs, Design, Technology, Renewable Energy. So the book really covers lots of areas of this global topic. And in Restoration, it gets into solving. The term solving for pattern was coined by Wendell Berry and refers to a solution that addresses multiple problems instead of one. Solving for pattern arises naturally when one perceives problems as symptoms of systemic failure rather than as random errors requiring anodynes. For example, sustainable agriculture addresses a number of issues simultaneously. It reduces agricultural runoff, which is the main cause of eutrophication and dead zones in lakes, estuaries, and oceans. It reduces use of energy-intensive nitrogen-based fertilizers. It ameliorates climate change because our organic soil sequesters carbon, whereas industrial farming releases carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Take a page and just study that all day. And again, connected with the native wisdom of all our relations and all is connected. Other phrases, life organizes with information. Nature works in cycles. Overall, a holistic approach and holistic solutions. Life tends to optimize rather than maximize. So, a lot of phrases to catch up with and see the thinking behind them. And perhaps impress people as you use the phrases because they are quite interesting. Ecological restoration is extraordinarily simple. You remove whatever prevents the system from healing itself. Social restoration is no different. We have the heart, knowledge, money, and sense to optimize our social and ecological fabric. It is time for all that is harmful to leave. 1 million escorts are here to transform the nightmares of empire and the disgrace of war on people and place. We are the transgressors and we are the forgivers. We means all of us, everyone. There can be no green movement unless there is also a black, brown, and copper movement. What is most harmful resides within us, the accumulated wounds of the past, the sorrow, shame, deceit, and ignominy shared by every culture passed down to every person as surely as DNA, a history of violence and greed. There is no question that the environmental movement is critical to our survival. Our house is literally burning, and it is only logical that environmentalists expect the social justice movement to get on the environmental bus. But it is the other way around. The only way we are going to put out the fire is to get on the social justice bus and heal our wounds, because in the end there is only one bus. Armed with that growing realization, we can address all that is harmful externally. What will guide us is a living intelligence that creates miracles every second, carried forth by a movement with no name. So in the climate change sense, climate crash sense, you know, the earth is, the earth house is on fire in a way, and that's what we're working towards, solving these issues. And, I appreciate how he ends the book with, living intelligence that creates miracles every second to remember that, you know, just when we think we know something and know a lot, that the reality of each day is that there is a living intelligence going on. Right in front of you, in the yard, wherever, that is creating miracles every second, that's keeping things alive and going on. And so if we can learn to connect with this sort of miracle or living intelligence, miracle, active, alive consciousness, it seems like that will help to help create the solutions. Just a little bit more from other parts of the book. We don't have one brain, but three, reptilian, limbic, and neocortical, and each has different functions. So it's just a real treasure trove of information here. It has been said that we cannot save our planet unless humankind undergoes a widespread spiritual and religious awakening. In other words, fixes won't fix unless we fix our souls as well. So let's ask ourselves this question: would we recognize a worldwide spiritual awakening if we saw one? Or, let me put the question another way, what if there is already in place a large-scale spiritual awakening and we are simply not recognizing it? In a seminal work, The Great Transformation, Karen Armstrong details the origin of our religious traditions during what is called the Axial Age, a 700-year period dating from 900 to 200 BC, during which much of the world turned away from violence, cruelty, and barbarity. The upwelling of philosophy, insight, and intellect from that era lives today in the works of Socrates, Plato, Lao Tzu, Confucius, Mencius, Buddha, Jeremiah, Isaiah, and others. Rather than establishing doctrinaire religious institutions, these teachers created social movements that addressed human suffering. They didn't create the movements. I mean, he writes, these movements were later called Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, monotheistic Judaism, democracy, and philosophical rationalisms. My little note is, but, you know, the founders, originators didn't create the isms, so that's another trap that humanity has gotten into, this individualized sort of hero, and then the ism that follows it. A recent quote from a John Pilger article: since about 1962, the U.S. Empire has mostly civilians as wounded, made homeless, or killed 20 million people. That is just, because it is not one dictator or one person. Over the years, I think we lose touch with the severity of it. So this book really connects a lot of dots and is very inspiring. Another section, this is the beginning of the chapter, immunity. It reminds me of the Chinese phrase, the great benevolence, of how to see the universe as really that there is a great benevolence that is working for the positive and for the good. In the 1960s, Sir James Lovelock began examining the possibility that the Earth might be a single living entity. The Gaia hypothesis, as he later named it, is ecology writ large. It asserts that the Earth, in creating conditions favorable to life, exhibits qualities of self-organization and self-regulation that are similar to those of a living organism. Two centuries earlier, Immanuel Kant and French economist Jacques Turgot imagined humanity itself as a similar entity, a system with some of the attributes of an organism. They were not alone. From Spinoza to Gandhi, from Louis Thomas to Teilhard de Chardin, philosophers, religious teachers, and scientists have all wondered if the entire human race might be integrated in mysterious and inexplicable ways. Joined together, the great mass of human minds around the Earth seems to behave like a coherent, living system. And to wrap up the show, since, you know, we have somebody in the Western, quote, Western society in the 1960s saying, I think everything is connected, which is wonderful, but, you know, the indigenous people have been saying this and others for so long that it's, you know, it's just the sense of, let's catch up and also start listening to them more with respect. So this little bit is one that has stood out over the years since reading this book as one of the most memorable. So I'm going to read this. This is about the Mi'kmaq people, which one of the interviews on the show was with Evan Pritchard, descendant of the Mi'kmaq people. And he has a new book out called Bird Medicine, which I'm aiming to get another interview with him at some point. And also, before wrapping up the show, want to announce ahead of time that in a couple of shows. Show number 52 is going to be the one-year anniversary of Between the Lines. Excited about that. The show has happened every week. I've missed 1 week, which was due to Hurricane Sandy when the electricity was off. So, one year anniversary coming up. That's going to be interesting and fun. To let you know, it's going to be very short interviews with some, if not all, of the people that have already been interviewed or conversationed with over the year, and each person getting two questions, the same two questions. The first question being basically, what do you think or what do you feel are what's needed, positive solutions to improve conditions with the planet, with the Mother Earth? And the second being, what is the one or two, try to keep it more than one, favorite or most significant or life-changing book you've ever read? That was one of the Between the Lines shows earlier in the year, was God Spare Me the Man of One Book, so don't want to pin anybody on one book, though you could have a favorite book. Okay, wrapping it up here with one more section from Blessed Unrest, how the largest social movement in history is restoring grace, justice, and beauty to the world. This actually was a New York Times bestseller, which is encouraging that many people have read it, and that it's crossed that divide of the system. The Mi'kmaq people know the world through sound. One of their tribal legends tells of three brothers, each of whom was granted a wish by a great magician named Glooskap. The first wanted to be tall, so all the women could see him. The second wanted to be secure in the bounty of the forest and never work again. The third wanted to never fall ill and to live a long life. Glooskap called in Kuk, C-U-H-K-W, called in Kuk the earthquake, who shook the land, seized the three, and planted them in the forest. The first became the tallest pine tree and could be seen for miles around. The second became the pine tree with the deepest roots and withstood the wind or any storm. And the third became the oldest pine tree and lived for centuries. To this day, the Mi'kmaq name their pine trees by the sound of the wind soughing through the branches 1 hour before sunset in the fall. Elders can remember the prior names of native stands of pine and detect how trees are changing due to environmental damage from acid rain and air pollution by comparing their names with the current sounds they make. Indigenous science is an observational science recorded in myths, stories, teachings, and, in particular, language. The tenacity of indigenous cultures and their dedication to place is stunning. So, a good example of depth and wisdom of indigenous awareness, and a reminder to really listen, and whether it's with the trees, or if we don't have the capability to detect the sound that the trees make, we can hear in each other's voices things and how we are doing and how we are feeling, and check in with each other that way. So thank you very much for listening. I'm going to go out with a track from a CD called Arctic Refuge, a gathering of tribes. I've played something from this before. This is Voices to the Sky, Cornell Puiwadi, Comanche Kiowa. Take care and have a good one.
Thank you.